Hello, welcome to the Creative Writing Life podcast. I'm Justin Sloan.
And I'm Paul Zeidman. I have the pleasure of introducing our guest today. I've known him for quite some time on social media. He's a swell guy and a fantastic writer and a filmmaker and just all around renaissance man. Hudson Phillips, welcome to the show.
Hey, what's up, guys? Thank you so much.
Our
Good
pleasure.
To have you.
Yeah. Paul, I actually feel like I might know you longer than anybody on social media because I think we had like WordPress blogs at the same time and like an embarrassingly long time ago that I've been following you for that long.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, my blog is through WordPress. And I've been doing mine since 2009. So, make of that what you will.
Yeah, I bet it goes back to 2009 then. That's the embarrassing long amount of time.
Oh, man. Yeah. Okay. That just makes me feel even that much more old today. So as we usually do, we'll start things off talking about something that we may have read or watched lately. Justin, do you want to start?
I'm trying to remember. How about Played? I recently started playing Red Dead Redemption 2. I was looking around online for people to recommend any kind of great story games. I'm a big fan of games where I don't feel like I'm forced to go do silly stuff, because then I start to feel like I'm just playing a game versus like I want the full interaction. And so a lot of people recommended Red Dead Redemption 2 and the Cyberpunk 2077. And I just started Red Dead 2. I'm only like 2 or 3 hours into it. And I'm like, yeah, this is it. This is good. I love it. So
that's cool. Did you play the first one?
I've not, no.
I didn't know. Is it necessary to have played the first one to play the second one? Is it like a continuation of the story?
I don't know if it's a continuation or not, but I definitely don't feel like I'm missing anything or like I'm confused about what's going on in the story or anything like that. So definitely is like a clean starting point.
Okay. Well, that's pretty cool.
I'm not a gamer at all, but it like when you say 2 to 3 hours, like how many hours will you get out of that? Like out of hundreds?
Yeah. No, yeah. I hope not. I don't know this one. Okay. Actually, I should look it up. But most games that I'm a fan of end up taking anywhere from like 8 to 10 hours. So it's just like a mini series, basically.
Gotcha.
Okay. Like watching a TV show. Yeah. But there are games that take hundreds, like probably Witcher 3 and a lot of those kind of games. And I try to avoid those as much as possible because, yeah, that's a time suck I can't afford.
Wow. But I always look at like entertainment as like the amount of time per dollar spent, and video games seems like the top end of that.
Oh yeah, but if they can keep you entertained the whole time, that's what I'm talking about. If it's just like a bunch of running around and doing like gathering mushrooms because somebody told you to, and it's like, well, come on, that's not entertaining for me. Yeah. For a lot of people, they love it, and so half the listeners out there are probably like, that's the best stuff.
Right. I can't stand repetitive tasks. And I think that's why video games and I don't click, or like doing the same thing over and over again. I can't do it.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Paul, what do you got for us?
I'm going to focus on the watching aspect. I wrapped up watching, I guess it's season one of The Sandman on Netflix. I really enjoyed it. I thought they did a really good job of adapting it from the comics. Looking forward to season two. And the latest film from our Netflix queue, I'd heard a lot of good things about it and was curious to know how it played for me, was Swiss Army Man, which is done by the Daniels, the two guys who also did Everything Everywhere All at Once from this year. And it was a very interesting movie. I would put it in the category of, I don't think I could ever write something like this. It was unique and very different. It was a little tough for me to understand in parts of it, but overall it was entertained. But I don't think I need to see it again. But I also liked Everything Everywhere a lot more than I did this. So I guess maybe their stuff is starting to grow on me.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Swiss Army Man and Everything Everywhere All at Once. But the Swiss Army Man had that weird experience. You're like, what am I watching? And
yeah.
Somewhere towards the end. And this happened in both of those movies where they're the weirdest movies you've ever seen. And then somehow it grips me emotionally. I ended up bawling, crying in both of those movies. And you're like, oh, you're crying at the, farting corpse movie. But that's what makes those filmmakers so miraculous is they somehow pull off that magic trick of what am I watching? This is ridiculous. And then they connect with you in some emotional way, or at least they did to me. And I've heard similar stories from other viewers as well.
I think the one question I have, especially about Swiss Army Man, was how in the world did they get this made? I mean, I did a little reading on it, and the script went through the Sundance Lab, and they went through like at least 5 major revisions of it. And I'm thinking, my God, how did they attract studio attention to this? How did they get the funding? But That's just a mystery for the ages, I guess. So Hudson, what have you been reading or watching?
Well, last night I watched The Menu. I don't know if you guys have seen it or not.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, it's Ray Fiennes, and he's a chef, and these kind of like stuck-up rich people go to have this fantastic meal, and things get horrific. But it's just it's a pitch-perfect satire. It's flawlessly done, incredible script. I absolutely loved it. It ends up saying a lot about, you know, the relationship of, you know, art with consumers and all kinds of deeper things than what it sounds like. But I had so much fun watching that. It's really, really great.
Excellent. Nice. Excellent. So let's get to, let's talk about All About Hudson today. So you are a writer and a filmmaker. So let's start with, like, how did you get your start? Have you always been a writer, or did you kind of like fall into it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's the story of most writers, where it's, you know, outcast kid, you know, suffering with some, you know, the loss of a parent and, you know, needing some kind of escape. And so for me, that was falling in love with, you know, movies and comic books and those kind of things. And then, you know, it wasn't just about escapism. It was about, you know, embracing myself through that process. And so that's where the writing came in. Had a seventh grade English teacher who invested in me the first time that, you know, I went above and beyond on classwork and got in front of the class and read my stories. And, you know, I was just bitten by that bug, and all through high school would create my own comic books and took my first shot at a screenplay in high school, and really just fell in love with it. And then somewhere in my late teens, early 20s, took a break and did music. That was kind of the cooler thing to do at the time. And then came back to screenwriting in my mid 20s, and just started writing from there. And yeah, for me, it's just always been just a love affair with words. And often, I mean, you guys know how difficult this screenwriting journey is. So often I'm like, man, should I have gone back and just written comics or just written novels or something that could actually be out in the world as opposed to sitting on a pile of scripts? But there's just something about movies that that I've now realized on this side of producing some things. The real magic is in the collaboration of it, and being able to work with other people and bring something to life with a community that I think makes movies more unique, and I think is a big part of why movies are special to me.
Oh, that's great. That's great. But yeah, that really raises a great point. Like, so how did you go, because you were doing all this writing, how did you get into the producing aspect of filmmaking?
Yeah, so it was by necessity. It was I was writing stuff. I kind of had a big win right out the gate. I was writing with two buddies of mine to begin with. We were writing comedies, and so it was a fun thing we were doing. And we ended up getting some attention for the second script we ever wrote. And like Lionsgate ended up optioning it. It was like this big kind of story locally. It was before Atlanta was really doing stuff. And so like, we were like on the radio and in the newspaper and all kinds of stuff. And then, it was like everything that could have gone wrong with that project did, you know, there was a writer strike. They dropped the option. A local company picked it up. They threw our script out. They rewrote it. They made it. I've never seen it. It was just like, you know, everything that could go wrong did. And then my two buddies I was writing with, they stopped writing. They're like, we wrote maybe another two scripts, but they were like, we can't do this anymore. It's just too difficult. I was like, look, I get it, but I couldn't let go. I had that bug. Right. And so, I had to redefine myself as a solo writer, and started in doing that dance of I'll write something. I'll try to make connections in LA. We had a couple from that script, but not as many as you think. And try to get something done. Nothing would happen. And along the side, this, you know, Atlanta started blowing up as a filmmaking community, with, you know, Hollywood coming here and filming stuff. So I was surrounded by people who, you know, were working on these big, you know, Hollywood movies, you know, as, you know, camera people or grip people or production design people or as bit part actors. And so I'm like, well, why don't we take advantage of the people around us and try to do something ourselves? At least we'll have made something as opposed to this pile of script that's getting higher and higher. And so I was lucky enough to run into a buddy of mine who I've known since high school, but we'd kind of separated. He was directing music videos. And so I was writing these scripts. I was like, hey, let's go make something. So we made this short film called Rooney's World, which was a ridiculously ambitious first short, but we didn't know any better. And that's kind of a running theme of my career, is just like, hey, I don't know any better. Let's just go do this crazy thing and see what happens. So it was like a mixture of live action and animation. It was about a kids show host. Is like a Blue's Clues kind of thing, where he gets let go from his show, and he doesn't know what to do with his life, and so he's trying to piece it together and learn how to be an adult. And his little animated co-host is this little pink elephant named Rooney, like gets in the way. He doesn't want him to grow up, so he keeps like, you know, sabotaging his dating life and stuff like that. But it was like 20 minutes, and it was just it was one of the most rewarding experiences of my life, just that collaboration. And it was insane, and we made a million mistakes and we learned a ton, but I just wouldn't you know, trade it for the world. And so we kept making a couple of those shorts, but the goal was always like to move towards a feature one day. And you know, this was 2013, 14, somewhere in there when we were doing this. And so like even the like, you know, ultra budget indie film thing, like there was a couple success stories, but you just didn't hear about it as much, you know? And so we just didn't have those models to go off of. So it always felt out there, you know, like we'll never get there. We'll never get there. And finally we just said, let's just do it. I sent my buddy Jordan, who's the director I do everything with, an idea for another short, which was like, hey, let's just go into the woods and shoot something. I'm itching to shoot something. And he took that idea and he said, well, what if we make it into a feature? So I turned that script around like really fast. It was like a 1 week for the first draft of that. And of course we rewrote it infinitely, but just to get something out the door. And it was kind of, I think we first had the idea in May and we ended up shooting that feature in August, was how fast it happened.
Wow.
And again, we didn't know any better. It was just like, you know, why can't we do that? And it was all based on, Jordan was a stay-at-home dad, his wife was a teacher. And so we knew we had to be done filming by the time school started back. And so that was our deadline for shooting a feature. And, you know, when you move towards something like that, with a deadline in place, what you find is that the train just starts moving. And the more pieces you build onto it, hey, let's bring on this actor, you know, who's a friend from, you know, that we've worked with on a short film. Let's bring on this DP who I met like on a dating site, you know, 10 years ago, and is, you know, we're doing amazing stuff now. And you just start building all these pieces, and that train gets so heavy that you can't stop it anymore. And that's kind of where we were with that movie. We were trying to raise 50 grand. I think we got to about 25 when we started filming. And so we certainly weren't there, and locations had fallen through and all kinds of things, but that train was moving. There was no stopping it. So we just went and we shot this thing for 10 days in the North Georgia mountains. And again, it was one of those, oh my God, this is what I want to be doing with my life. And that's almost like the happy ending of it, because, you know, then you have to go through post, and we had to raise more money, and it took 4 years in total to get this thing finished. And it was just a nightmare in a lot of ways, but also very rewarding in a lot of ways. And that's that kind of describes the writing life, I think. But yeah, we that ended up being a success story. That was the movie This World Alone, which is out on Hulu now. And it was a very long journey to get there. But pretty cool, right? That we could, you know, scrounge up this money, scrounge up these people, just friends in our area. We find a location that is, you know, North Georgia is just gorgeous. So anywhere we point a camera, it's going to look fantastic. So we don't need to worry about, you know, fancy equipment and stuff. And we just did it. And luckily it ended up paying off for us.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you are based in Atlanta. I believe you mentioned that a couple of times. Yep. So what is the Atlanta writing community like? Is it big? Are there a lot more people there than you would expect? And are there a lot of events? Do you do a lot of networking through the area? And do you have a writing group?
Yeah, you know, that question, the answer would be very different, you know, 3 years ago. And I was involved in a lot of things, and there were a lot going on, and there still are. I'm just, you know, it's a couple things. COVID, you know, really separated a lot of people, and, you know, trying to stay in touch virtually. But also, I'm just getting kind of older, and I don't get a lot of energy out of going to those kind of random meetings and things. So I've kind of pulled myself back from a little bit of that. However, I do stay in touch with a lot of people virtually, and still, you know, take meetings online, and I still connect with people or grab lunch with people when I can. And then in addition to, but yeah, Atlanta is really thriving. There's some very cool things happening in Atlanta. There's actually a organization called Roll Call out of Ponce City Market, which is like, you know, cool shopping area downtown. And they just launched like a monthly screenplay read where like pilots or features, and they do it in front of an audience. And so people like pay to like come see these things. So there's some very cool things happening, that you don't even see in, you know, bigger cities. So Atlanta is a cool, creative community in that way. It's disconnected in a lot, or it was in the past. But I'm starting to see it gel a little more. And I think it's a cool place, cool creative place to be. And the reason I say it was kind of disconnected in the past is, what you saw traditionally in Atlanta is, you know, hey, we're this cool small artist community. And then Hollywood comes in with their steamrollers and they're like, no, we're a big Hollywood city. And you see a little bit of a tension between those two things. And then you see, and then what happens is those small artists are like, hey, where's our shot? You know? And so you see a little bit of bitterness there. And that was what I kind of kept seeing a little bit over and over, and why I felt like I needed to take a break is I'm a very, you know, positive, forward thinking guy. I just don't need that kind of energy. But there are very cool things happening, and the people that are, you know, the people that last are the ones with the positive energy, I think. But in addition to, you know, the Atlanta scene, I also have a writer's group that, I do through, you know, the organization I started called Script Blast, where we meet, you know, biweekly. So I'm constantly in front of writers, and connecting with them, sharing our work, inspiring each other. And I do think that that's necessary for writers, because it is a lonely, long journey. And just to know you aren't alone is everything. So when I hop on one of those calls with that group and just say, hey, here's my week, here's why it sucked, here's why it was awesome, and everybody else does the same thing, you hop off those calls and you just feel, you know, reinvigorated. And so for that, for me, is what a writer's group is really about. It's about that emotional side. It's almost like writer's therapy, more so than, you know, can you give me feedback on this script? But the difficult part with that, and, you know, I've been doing Trip Blast for a while, we can go into that a little bit if you guys want, is, you know, as someone who is, you know, trying to help writers, there's what I think writers need, and there's what I think writers want. And I think what writers need is they need to be held accountable. They need to push their productivity to where they're, you know, writing every day. And they need to have that positive mindset in a place where they can talk about their journey in a safe environment. And what they want is for you to tell them they're awesome writers, right? So that's why, you know, the whole, you know, screenwriting industry is built around notes and built around contests, because those are ways where, you know, I can enter, I pay some money, and I immediately get some feedback saying that I'm awesome or not awesome, as often is the case. But that's what I think people are looking for. And so there's always that bit of tension in what I've been doing with Script Blast as well.
That is fantastic. And good on you for like running Script Blast. I mean, I was a part of it, but I had to unfortunately drop out just because my schedule was getting so busy. But I've seen all the great things that you're doing with it. And it's just great that you're able to really offer that kind of support. And I think it's equally great that you can do it for both Script Blast, but also it sounds like you don't do it as much for the Atlanta area, but you know, still that vibe is still there, and that's great.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I could jump in and going back to your film, This World Alone. So a couple questions about Hulu specifically and like getting it there. So like say somebody's in that same boat, they just finished a movie. What was your experience getting it onto Hulu to begin with? And the follow-up kind of that is like, what's it like now that it's on Hulu? I've heard a lot of stories of films getting onto Amazon and then that's kind of it. And like people never make any profit off of it. Is it similar for Hulu or is this a different kind of ballgame?
Yeah, I'll walk through what we did, and then I can walk through what we would do differently. So what we did with This World Alone was we finished it. What do we do with this thing? We entered way too many film festivals. I think we entered like 60, which was just a waste of money because what you learn after going through the process is all those, you know, major festivals aren't going to touch a $30,000 film, no matter what it is, if you don't have some sort of connection or a name in your movie. Right. So we just wasted a bunch of money, like trying to like, wouldn't it be cool if, you know, South by Sundance, all that kind of stuff. But what we did find is we got into about a dozen festivals, some dinky local ones, some, I shouldn't say dinky, every festival was a lot of fun, but just on the smaller side, some mid-tier ones that were amazing experiences that we wouldn't trade for the world. And we did that for about a year, and which was awesome for us personally, because we love connecting with other filmmakers. We love watching our movie in an audience. And so that gave us that opportunity. And then, so that took a year, and then we tried to get distribution for that film. I think, again, we reached out to about a dozen different places for distribution, and we did get offers from about five of them. And the biggest reason I think we got offers was we had a little bit of clout from doing those festivals. And so we'd won some, you know, best feature kind of stuff, some other awards. And so people see that and was like, you know, at some point that's a losing game, but you know, if you've got, you know, three or four of those, it's kind of cool. I always kind of roll my eyes when you see those like short films on YouTube or whatever. And it's just like a wall of like 50 laurels. And I was like, all right, none of them mean anything if you have that many, you know? But yeah, so we ended up signing with this distribution company called 1091. And we went with them for a couple of reasons. The biggest of which was they were like, we love your poster. We love your trailer. We don't want to change anything about it. And, you know, it's kind of like dating. It's like you find the person who accepts you for who you are. Whereas we talked to some other companies who were like, let's sell this as a horror movie. Let's redo your art and stuff. It's like, well, that's not the movie is. Like, even if that gets eyeballs on it, they're going to watch that movie and be disappointed because it's not a horror movie. You know, it is kind of a thriller, but it's really a slow paced kind of drama thing, even though it's a post-apocalyptic story. And so we really connected with 1091, and but that process took another year before it came out. And so it was a really, really long process. And what they do for you is they put you on all major platforms. So iTunes, Amazon, you know, Voodoo, I don't know what all is out there, Google Play, whatever, for purchase and for rent. So they do that whole process. You lead up to a big release. So we were on like iTunes New and Notable, which was cool. We tried to get as much press as possible. We had blown through our money doing the festival stuff. And so we had no money for PR kind of stuff, which, you know, lesson learned. And so they also, once you, the way distribution kind of lays out is you do, you know, transactional video. So TVOD, that's transactional video on demand, is the first tier, you know, purchase and rentals. The next tier is SVOD, so streaming. And so they pitched us to different streaming companies, and, you know, Hulu came back and said that they wanted to pick us up. I'll say, in terms of, you know, is that a lucrative deal or not? First of all, they're not exclusive, so we can go to other streamers. And another streaming company that I had never even heard of did pick it up. And so it's, I'll say that the Hulu deal on its own was not lucrative in terms of making our money back. It was, and it is also spread out over a long period of time. So it's like a, you know, I think 3.5 years, quarterly payments, something like that. And so it's a very long journey. I think the movie will end up being profitable once you add everything up, eventually, but it's certainly not there yet. And we've been out for 2 years now. But the things that I would do differently is a shorter festival window, focusing on festivals that you're going to travel to, focusing on mid-tier festivals, which are the ones that, you know, you're not going to read about in the trades and stuff, but that people kind of go to. I mean, like the two that we went to that were the best experiences were Oxford Film Festival in Mississippi and Phoenix Film Festival in Arizona. And they were just filmmaker friendly festivals with thousands of people there to watch your movie. So they were just really cool experiences, even though they're not going to, you know, open doors necessarily. And then luckily enough, we had that movie come out, and because of that Hulu deal and because of, you know, we had a write-up in the New York Times, which came out of nowhere. That was a positive vibe. And we did a run on, you know, podcasts and stuff. We had a, I had a guy reach out to me and said, hey, I heard you on this podcast. I love the way that you talked about how you treat people on set, how you make your movies. And I heard you pitch this new idea you were talking about. Can I read it? So I sent it to this guy. I'd never heard of him. No idea who he is. He reads it. And he's like, hey, I want to pay for this movie. So, so our second feature, he ended up, single-handedly paying for, we just shot that in January, and it's another long, you know, post process for that. But that's how these things work. You know, you think that, I'm like, oh, this first movie is going to blow up. Our careers are going to, you know, go huge, and, you know, so-and-so will pick it up, and, you know, all those dreams will come true. And then that stuff doesn't happen. But what you find instead is it's just this slow roll of just like, you know, all these things coming together. And you can't predict where they're going to come from. And they just keep going and keep going and build up over time. It's kind of like, you know, when you're in the moment, it feels so small. And then when you look back, you're like, oh my God, it's all these huge wins. So yeah.
Yeah, no, I feel that sometimes lately. So that's, and it's good advice. So for your next project after this now, do you have a strategy, or do you already have some financing for the next one, or you're just going to kind of see what's happening? What's the plan?
Yeah, we're going to see what's happening. Honestly, after doing this next one, so we doubled our budget for this next movie. And I honestly wish that we had stuck with a smaller budget. And part of that is because of what we learned off of This World Alone, is that just the financial model for micro budget films just doesn't super exist. You know, unless you have a giant following, unless you have a star in your movie, that kind of stuff. And we got lucky on this next one. We've got, it's not an A-list actor or whatever, but Randy Havens, who plays the, you know, the science teacher on Stranger Things, is in it. So it's at least somebody recognizable in the genre space. And it's another kind of grounded genre thing. It's mostly two people in one house. So we kept the cost low in terms of, you know, how it was designed. But all that to say, the next one, I really want to do something super cheap, because I want to get any obstacles out of the way. And I think this is where most filmmakers fail, first-time filmmakers fail, is they say, I have to put all my eggs in this one basket. And so if it can't be perfect, if it can't be this giant film that I've been wanting to make all my life, then I don't want to do it. But again, it goes back to that incremental thing. So, you know, I just want to keep making movies. And if I can do that for, you know, 10 grand in a friend's house, and I just write something to that, then that's what I want to keep doing, because those are the really rewarding experiences, are being on set and collaborating with other creative people and creating something, you know, beautiful together. And I adore writing, and I'm always going to be writing my entire life. But there's just something special about connecting with other people. And I want to figure out how to make that possible more often. Cause like I said, it was a 4-year journey for This World Alone. I think it'll end up being a 4-year journey for the second one, called Guacamole Yesterdays. We're hoping to have it out next year, doing a festival run in the fall again. The distribution for that one, we'll do, you know, a smaller festival run. I think our investor is interested in doing it a little bit differently. You know, we don't want to put it in front of a million eyeballs before we have the opportunity to sell it, same things like that. But yeah, every new thing is a learning journey, and I want to keep doing it.
Awesome. Yeah, last question for me is just along those lines. I was going to ask, do you feel that you've hit any kind of burnout yet, or what would be your signs, your red flags for, you're like, oh man, I better watch out, I might hit that burnout soon?
That's a great question. I'm not really a kind of burnout type of personality. I'm ambitious. And I think I am, delusional enough to just keep going. When I get burnt out is usually when I find myself not creating or not connecting. And, you know, it really goes back to, I think maybe 15 years ago, I did this exercise that was all about, you know, where do I find my passion and my energy? And those are two of those things, creating and connecting. And so creating, writing, it's like I'll be, you know, moping around the house or depressed or something. And my wife will be like, hey, go write something, right? Because it's like, if I'm not constantly creating something, I find myself depressed and burnt out. And the same thing for connecting. If I'm, you know, writing by myself for months at a time, I'll get burnt out and I need to go collaborating and connect with someone. I think, you know, as long as I keep those two buckets full, that, you know, they keep adding and I can keep pushing forward. But when one of those buckets starts to get low, that's where burnout creeps in.
Okay, cool. Paul, back to you.
Okay. So we kind of talked about this a little bit before we started recording. I wanted to bring it up. So last night, when we're recording this, last night for Justin was the Roadmap Writers holiday party in Los Angeles. And for me in San Francisco, it was the Bay Area Film Mixer. It was their quarterly get together, but it also was a combination holiday party. And so I think it's a combination of event for enjoyment, but also it was a networking thing. So I wanted to, Justin, I want to ask you about your experience there and I can talk about it. And then Hudson, I'm sure as someone who organizes a writing group that, you know, what kind of things would you try to have going on for a networking event? But so while you're mulling on that, so let's go to Justin to tell us about his experience.
Yeah. Yes. I attended the Roadmap holiday party last night at a bar in LA. And it was awesome. I was, you know, doing that thing beforehand that many of us do, maybe who are like me, antisocial, who are like, oh, maybe I should just stay home. I don't know. The kids are going to miss me and all that. But then my wife's like, hey, we moved to LA for a reason. Get your butt out there. So I did. And I took an Uber so that at least it would take that little extra amount of strain and anxiety off my chest, because I hate driving, you know, in the evenings in LA and trying to find parking. It's just not worth it. Yeah. So I took an Uber down there and it was great. I met a lot of fun people, met some people that have been on the podcast before, like Brian Fitzsimmons and Isabella Dreon. Is that your last name? Mm-hmm. And a few others.
Brian Fitzpatrick.
Yeah. Brian Fitzpatrick, a bunch of great people. And I mean, I think this is perfect. It was kind of like a little slice of Austin Film Festival here in Los Angeles, which is what I'm always looking for. So any of those future events like that, I'm definitely going to be attending.
That's great. Awesome. So, okay. And so for me, it was not just writers, but it was also a lot of Bay Area filmmakers and people involved in the filmmaking industry here. And it was really nice. I mean, it was at a bar, karaoke bar kind of thing. And so it was a little like some drinks and mingling and just really a lot of networking, getting to talking to a few people I actually knew. So that was nice, and getting to meet some new people. And what was really cool is that there's like a little theater in the back of the place. And so then they did a screening. They showed one of the people attending, it was a trailer for her short film. They're going to show the short film on the next one, I think is in March. And that looked really cool. And since it was the holiday party, they had someone had done like a Christmas themed short, which was very Black Mirror-esque. And then they had a comedy short, which was probably about 15 minutes long. And it's about these, you know, it was three guys and they're stuck in a house during a lockdown. And they inadvertently order like a ton of stuff, a ton of Christmas stuff from Amazon. So they decide to have Christmas in July. And they kind of have a lot of fun with the tropes of like Christmas specials and the holiday spirit, that sort of thing. It was just a lot of fun. And I really enjoyed it. I mean, I think it's great for writers and filmmakers to go to those kind of networking things. And as you said, Justin, you know, we're all introverted to begin with, but sometimes you kind of have to force yourself out there. And so I want to throw things to Hudson now. So have you been able to do those kinds of things in the Atlanta area?
Yeah, I've hosted Scriptblast events both here and in LA actually, and then also have attended quite a few here in Atlanta. I think that the most successful ones are ones that don't try to do too much. You know, just throw people in a room with some drinks and let them chat. And that's where, you know, really lasting relationships come from. And I think that's the point, is just to connect people so that they get to know each other. I think anytime you add an element of, hey, let's trade business cards and talk shop and, you know, all that kind of stuff, that it gets just disingenuous and not really the point of it. Like I would hate to go to one where it's like writers and producers thrown together, or like writers and, I don't know, agents or something. Like, God, that would be a nightmare. Cause then you're just feel like you're competing for someone's time. And, you know, it just seems like it would be really gross. But yeah, you know, I mean, it just should just be, it should be fun, and you should connect with other people in your area. And I'm a big believer that, and I've seen this in my own career, that, you know, the people that are no names that you connect with when you're a no name, you know, 10, 15 years down the road, we'll all be doing amazing, awesome stuff alongside you. So like, don't write anybody off and just, you know, connect with those people at your same level.
Oh yeah. I totally agree, because I see the networking events. It's really a great opportunity, not just socialize and get to know members of your community, but you're also establishing these professional relationships that, you know, someone who you're talking to, you know, he's maybe struggling with a script today, but a couple of years down the road, he could be like the hottest name in writing, or, you know, hey, sure. I that big blockbuster. Yeah, that guy wrote that. So, you know, and so just, it kind of emphasizes the, just be nice to everybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure. No, I mean, that's a cool. One thing I was going to say is that at Austin, they had some of these parties where it was like managers and agents and writers together. And I was very surprised, and that it wasn't bad at all like that. It was actually just a lot of fun.
That's awesome.
Maybe they only invited, like I was thinking it was specifically a private party kind of, and maybe they only invited people of a certain caliber that, you know, aren't going to be like the sleazy ones. Yeah. Not sure, but
maybe I'm not giving people the benefit of the doubt too. You know, I mean, it's easy being on Twitter all day that you just assume everybody is sleazy, and then in person, people are a little more cool.
Yeah, well, one would hope anyway.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. This has been great stuff, Hudson. Where can people find you online?
I'm at Hudson Phillips on just about everything, I think. At Script Blast is my other handle on just about everything. Script Blast is a little dead lately. I've gotten burned out on marketing and social media, and just needed a break from it. And it might end up being a permanent break. We'll see. But I still do stuff on my permanent, on my personal channels. It's just, you know, going back to burnout. That's where I get burnout, is having to turn on those like sales and marketing part of my brain. And so I've been reevaluating a lot of that lately. And as a writer, even like that's the toughest part, is I don't want to be doing that stuff. I don't want to have a social media presence where I have to post every day and, you know, be, you know, keeping my face in front of people. Like, I just want to write and I want to connect, you know? That's where I get burnout the most, is just feeling any kind of, you know, pressure to do those things that don't bring me energy.
Okay. That makes sense.
Sorry, that got kind of dark. I was just sharing my Instagram handle and then went off on this tangent.
Well, you got to remember, like, you know, we're all writers, but we're also people. And, you know, it is, you know, sometimes burnout is just one of those things that happen. But, you know, you got to do what's right for Hudson.
That's right. That's right. And some people are awesome at that, and they really thrive at that. I mean, like, and I follow those people and I'm inspired by them, you know, but yeah, that's totally true. It's what's right for each person.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's great. So at Hudson Phillips and at Script Blast on all the socials and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Hudson, this has been a great show. And so a lot of great information and some great stories too.
Thanks. Yeah. You guys are awesome. This was really fun.
Yeah. Thank you so much. All right, listeners, if you could leave reviews, spread word of mouth and all that, it'd be amazing. Once again, I'm Justin Sloan. You can find my books on Amazon.
I'm Paul Zeidman. You can check out my screenwriting blog at Maximum Z. It's a MaximumZ.blog. I'm also on Twitter at Maximum_Z. And I got books on Amazon too. Just type in my name and all three of them will pop up. And the holidays are coming. They make great gifts. Like you said, he's Justin, he's Hudson, and I'm Paul. This has been the Creative Writing Life Podcast. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and most importantly, go write something.